Good morning, everyone. How are you doing? I know the summer heat kind of sucks it out of us, but I hope you're doing well this morning. I want you to start off this morning by thinking back to a dating relationship you've had that went really, really well. Now, maybe some of you are like my wife. I am her only boyfriend ever. I know. But maybe some of you are like me, where you're thinking about, okay, which three-month stint dating relationship do I have to think back on? Maybe some of you are thinking to a relationship that went really well. What did that feel like? What did that seem like? I mean, you're walking through this relationship and you are on cloud nine. You are walking on sunshine the whole thing through, like never one spat, never one fight. Everything just goes so stinking well. But what about one that doesn't work out so well? Where every day is a fight. Everything's a struggle. You're constantly going through difficulty and it just seems to drain you. It's like going to a dentist. It stays with you. The pain just doesn't go away. I recognize in this room, we have a mix of both. We do. I want to encourage you to keep coming and listening to this series. In our world today, dating has become a monster. Romantic relationships become such a struggle. It's built on the infrastructure of ambiguity and liberty. It's based on attraction. And we don't learn from the mistakes of our snap decisions. We go out with somebody and then, you know, we think it's great. And then all of a sudden it turns out they're not the person that they were at the beginning. Shocker, they were putting their best foot forward. And then we turn around and we think, okay, this next person's going to be better. And it turns out they're human too. Oh, but this person is going to be an angel from God. She walks like an angel, talks like an angel, and we think, oh, it's going to be perfect this time. And we don't learn from that snap decision. And we dive deep emotionally. We draw close spiritually, and then suddenly we find the physical following closely behind. I hope that doesn't shock any of you, because we are a whole being. You cannot separate the spiritual and emotional from the physical. They go hand in hand. You can't draw close to somebody emotionally and expect the physical to step by the side. We're going to see a little bit of that today in our passage. Where one goes, all of them goes. And we end up in this enmeshment relationship where, sure, we hang out with each other at the beginning with our friends and everything else like that, but then eventually it's just, okay, it's just you and me alone and nobody else is allowed. We got to have our private time. Proverbs 26:11 has a lot of wisdom for the dating world today. It says this, like a dog that returns to his vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. We didn't learn what made us sick the last time, and we just go right back to it. How much abuse can we take before we wake up to the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result? Are we ready for a different way? Now, I recognize sitting in this room this morning or listening online, there are those who have had it very rough with the subject matter that we're going to be discussing in this series. And we have this picture in our mind that is just very dark and painful or even grotesque. I want you to understand something that I had to learn. When I came across this book, I really struggled with the Song of Solomon. Like, I shouldn't be thinking about what this book talks about because it is just so dark in my mind. Let me tell you, God didn't accidentally put this book in the Bible. Out of 66 books of the Bible, he dedicated one to this topic of human sexuality and marriage. Because it is vitally important. It wasn't like he went, whoops, how'd I let Solomon get that one in there? He has a purpose for it. I want to encourage you to read this because what I had grown up with, this idea of sexuality and dating, it was one of two things. Either something really forbidden and you hang out and do that on the side and don't let mom and dad find out and you get sneaky with it. Or it was something you never talk about it. We don't discuss that. We wouldn't even say that word in church growing up. And I grew up where it was one of those two options. You either had, to put it into a picture, you had the junk food burger of Burger King, where you know you're going to get a heart attack eventually if you keep eating that, right? Or you never have a burger in your life. Not once did I hear the conversation about a good Red Robin or Ruby Tuesday burger, where it's done right, half-pound patty, cooked from fresh beef, and it's delicious. Friends, I want to tell you something. Sexuality and marriage and intimacy is meant to be done the right way. Who invented this idea of sexuality, by the way? Not us. And it wasn't human beings. It wasn't like the first man and the first woman looked at each other and goes, huh, wonder what happens. God designed it. And he designed it to be beautiful. He designed it to be a wonderful depiction of the love and intimacy that exists in the Godhead itself. We would never be able to understand the intensity of love and devotion that God has between the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, as well as for us, without this gift. But we have to understand it in its proper context, in its proper way. We are in this book, Song of Solomon. We will be in chapter 2 today. Actually, we will be starting in chapter 1. We will be going through chapter 2. Because we have this terrible approach to marriage in the church as well as outside the church. Outside the church, it's just, well, let's not say outside the church. We have two extremes. Either you stay committed because you made a covenant with God and you're stuck together. Or you are only together so long as you're interested in each other. And we go heartbreak after heartbreak after heartbreak. Are we ready for a different way? Are we ready to listen to some wisdom? Now, I have to admit, Solomon has a lot of wisdom when it comes to marriage because he did it an awful lot. He had hundreds of wives. But I believe wholeheartedly that God gave him wisdom about this. It was more than just a political marriage that he sings about here. Are you open to exploring another foundation other than just attraction? That's what we talked about last week. Attraction's good, but it is not the most important thing. I believe there is a much better foundation for a relationship, and that is clarity. Clarity. Throughout this book, we see the maturation of a marriage. In chapter 1, we saw attraction. In chapter 2, they get to spend time together, and they're in the dating and courtship phases. Dating meaning, could this be marriage? Could this be where this is heading? To courtship being, yes, this is heading towards marriage. Let's start planning towards that end. In chapter 3, we get a sneak peek of their honeymoon and their marriage. In chapter 4, we get an insight into the wedding chamber, the way God designed it. In chapter 5, immediately after their first time together, they have a fight. It's pretty fitting. There's conflict. There's tension. We get to see how they work through that. In chapters 7 through 8, there's deepening, and it takes intentionality to have a deepening relationship. This is not just for single people. This is not just for married people. This is for all of us. It does speak of a reflection of God's love, but either you are married, you one day will be married, or might be in a dating relationship, or you will at least know somebody who is, that is going to need godly counsel. And if nothing else, the church should be able to stand up and say, stop, this is a bad idea. I must admit, because I really don't care about the theme of this month, I did not plan for this series to be during Pride Month. But since it is, let me just challenge you a little bit. Why should those outside the church have a monopoly on the conversation about sexuality? If you just admitted that God designed it, why should we not discuss it? Tastefully, in its proper context. Now, I'm not saying, you know, we're hateful against those. No. We love all, okay? And it's because I love you, I want you to understand the way God designed this thing to work. He designed it. And much like an atomic bomb, if you don't handle it with respect, you will soon regret it. It's dangerous, but it is powerful. You can either use it in a way that is explosive and destructive, or with the same element, create something that will fuel and endure and last for generations. Now, this couple is beginning to spend some time together in this Song of Songs, and how they communicate flies in the face of what we are told in our culture today. Let's pick back up. We left off in 1:7. It says, "Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it to lie down at noon. For why should I be like the one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions?" Just so you understand, to remember where we left off, she's saying, I want to hang out with you. I want to be in a public place, and I am not going to compromise on my morals. I'm not going to be like one of those shady ladies that shows up and offers themselves bodily to your friends. I'm not doing that. I'm not that type of girl. My mama raised me better. And she said, I'm not going to be like that. But then we're going to see something. The way a man treats a woman changes the way she sees herself. We pick that up in the remainder of this chapter, where she describes herself in ways that are very different. And it's because of the way he treats her. He says, "If you do not know, O most beautiful among women, follow in the tracks of the flock and pasture your young goats beside the shepherd's tents." He's inviting her. Hey, you want to meet? Here's how to find it. Here's the spot. We're going to hang out with a group. We're going to be in a public setting. And then he starts to describe her beauty. He says, "I compare you, my love, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with strings of jewels." He calls her a mare. Guys, if you're in the dating phase, do not say that I told you to compare your girl to a horse. Does not go well, all right? It's important to know what he's describing here. He compares her to a particular mare. He says, a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. In Egypt, they were known for their horses. In fact, Israel would constantly go to them for horses and chariots. But there were a select breed of horses that stood out from the rest that Pharaoh would keep reserved for his chariots. They were the fastest, strongest, most beautiful. And he is saying, look, honey, sure, other ladies can be pretty, but you are unique amongst them. There's no one as beautiful as you in my mind. And then he goes on to describe her cheeks and her neck. I'd encourage you at some point to look up a picture of how this man describes his bride. It's pretty goofy if we don't understand poetry. And he's using very poetic language that she would understand. Now, they're not just having this conversation alone. They are not doing this in the privacy of an online messaging or texting or in private. There's a whole community listening in. And they say this, "We will make for you ornaments of gold studded with silver." They're approving of this. They're celebrating it. Mature Christians, those of you that have been married for a few years, do you celebrate God-honoring love when you see it? Do you rejoice at it? Do you uplift them? Those of you that are in a dating relationship, what does your community of faith say about your relationship? Don't just blow them off. If they aren't celebrating that, pay attention. There is something there. I'm not saying just because somebody disapproves of your dating relationship, it's off. Something you should know about Adri and I. We pursued marriage against the wishes of her parents. Now, there's a whole story that goes in there. But we sought the input of godly men and women apart from them. And by the grace of God, by the time we were getting married, we had their blessing. We had worked through a lot of things. So I'm not saying completely break off a relationship just because somebody says so, but pay attention to it. When everybody is saying, whoa, 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 hold up, are you sure that's the type of person? Pay attention to that. Proverbs 18:1 puts it this way, whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire. He breaks out against all sound judgment. Do not isolate yourself in those relationships. This doesn't just stop because you're a teenager. And it doesn't just stop because you get married. What does your community say about your marriage? What do brothers and sisters in Christ say about the way you treat each other? Keep community in your relationships. Because all too often I see this while people are dating. I mentioned it earlier. They isolate themselves. We just cut off everybody else. And all of a sudden they're just spending time alone. And their friends are like, where'd they go? Well, he found another girl. Oh, time for him to ghost us, huh? And then the breakup happens and all the friends get the sobbing phone call and they're trying to reconnect and they don't even know who each other are anymore because they have been sequestered from each other because of this relationship. Don't let that happen to you. By the way, I want you to notice something. It goes on from here. He says, while the king was on his couch, my nard gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh. And notice, the king is on his couch. They're at the king's banqueting hall. In this verse, and in verse 17, and in 2:4, they are either at a king's table, they're around a park, or at a banqueting hall. They're in a public setting. This is a safeguard against the trap of jumping the gun on physical intimacy. Listen, there are certain parts of physical intimacy that God has designed as a wedding gift, and we spoil it when we unwrap it too soon. So make sure that you have safeguards from diving too deep too quickly. Because I have never, in my premarital counseling and marriage counseling, I have never heard of somebody that they were out in public. You know, we were just sitting at the brew, having a cup of coffee, and one thing led to another, and that's how we ended up making a mistake physically. It's always this. Well, we were alone. We were alone at home, and his parents were away, or we were alone in the car at the parking spot, and one thing led to another. It's always one thing led to another. Well, stop it at the one thing. Can't lead to another. You know, we were sitting at Burger King and I just couldn't resist. Does not happen. Why do we have to cut ourselves off? That isn't anything like reality, by the way. You get married, you have kids, you are never alone. Ever. And then the kids move off and you've got your friend group and you're always together with them. Why don't you start practicing that in the dating process? Remaining connected in the midst of that. Because seduction loves to get you alone. Look at Proverbs 7, 6 through 7. Let's just listen to this. Solomon, who's the namesake of this book, describes seduction and how it works. He says, for at the window of my house I have looked out through my lattice, and I have seen among the simple, I have perceived among the youths, a young man lacking sense, passing along the street near her corner, taking the road to her house in the twilight, in the evening, at the time of night and darkness. And behold, the woman meets him, dressed as a prostitute, wily of heart. And then she goes on to talk about every sort of sensual thing, what you can see in her bedroom, what you will smell, what you will feel. And she is appealing to all his senses. But it's very subtle until she lures him into the private setting. He goes on to say, all at once he follows her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a stag is caught fast till an arrow pierces its liver, as a bird rushes into a snare, he doesn't know that it will cost him his life. It's gonna feel great right up until the moment it kills you. It is going to appeal to every single one of your senses until it is ready to destroy you. I remember when we were dating, Adrian and I, this is not me boasting, this was good advice given to me by godly men and women, like a pastor standing up in a pulpit saying this, so listen carefully. We were never alone in a place that somebody could not walk in at a second. She wouldn't let me. Praise God. Made sure that I kept my hands, my eyes, my mind, and my heart where they were supposed to be. I don't regret it. Not once. We would go to a park where our friends would be. Or we would sit in our college cafeteria. Or we would go down to a restaurant in town where we had friends working. Or we would simply walk along the streets of town, but we were never alone. If we were ever in a building, it was always in a place where either somebody else was or would be very soon. So they would walk in, and they would know we've done nothing. So she says, while the king was on his couch, Marnard gave forth its fragrance. That was a spice that was used for perfume. My beloved is to me as a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. We guys read verse 13, and all we do is see breasts. And it catches us off guard. And we think, this is in the Bible? This is one of those passages that we look at and go, oh, they slipped it in there. And we miss something. This is not a description of something sensual or sexual. This is saying that there's something about him that she just cannot stop thinking about him. Thoughts of him are like a lingering perfume, because more than just spraying perfume on, they would actually carry the herbs in a little satchel around their neck. And she is saying, your thoughts of you are lingering. I can't stop thinking about you. So guys, let me warn you about something. Wherever you are in a relationship on a scale of 1 to 10 about how intense you are, she is 3 steps ahead of you. If you are a 2, she's a 5. If you are at 5, she is an 8. If you are a 7, you better have the ring picked out. Guys, don't play games with that. Be careful with that. However intimate you think you are in the relationship, she is steps ahead of you. Be careful with that. She's thinking about you. She can't stop thinking about you after you're done with the date, or as you're heading up to the date. You are on her mind. So be very careful. She says, my beloved is to me as a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyard of En-Gedi. And then he responds to her thinking about him by describing what she thinks about her. He says, behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Notice what he notices about her. She has just described, she just used the word describing part of her anatomy. What does he focus on? Her eyes. It's like the Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi. Look eyes, always look eyes. The eyes are the gateway to the soul. This isn't inappropriate. He values her, and he sees beauty in her for more than something, for something more than just physical gratification. He's looking at her eyes. When I first started dating Adrian, one of my friends said, what color are her eyes? He was quizzing me. Not only could I tell him the color, I could tell him the pattern that was in her eyes. And he goes, good, you're looking at the right spot. Yes. And then she responds, behold, you are beautiful, my beloved, truly delightful. Our couch is green. The beams of our house are cedar. Your rafters are pine. She describes him as pleasant to look at. How do you think this is making each other feel in this relationship? They're drawing closer. They're recognizing beauty in each other. Not only that, there's something in us that wants to be deemed beautiful. Yes, even we men want to be thought of as pleasant. Do you enjoy being around me or not? How would you feel if someone were to use these words of you, you see this is drawing each other closer. But then she says this of herself, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Pause there just for a second. Remember, they're drawing closer. They're talking about the good that they see in each other, and it's more than just for physical gratification. And she says of herself, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Wait a minute, back up. How did she describe herself at the beginning of chapter 1? Don't look at me. I'm dark. My skin has been more than just kissed by the sun. I am darkened by the sun. I'm lovely, but I'm not beautiful. Now what is she saying about herself? She's describing herself as something beautiful, fragrant, fertile, sweet. What's changed? Him in her life. It's his treatment of her. He made her better. He exalted her. He cherished her. He highlighted her good qualities until she started to see it herself. The way a man treats a woman will impact, will change the way she sees herself. What would have happened if he just said, yep, you're right, let's go to bed? How would she see herself? Oh, I'm an object for his pleasure. I'm nothing more than something to satisfy his urges. Elizabeth Elliot, the widow of Jim Elliot, put it this way. It's a deadly error to fall into the notion that when feelings are extremely strong, we can do nothing but act on them. I guarantee you, because of the way they are describing things here, their emotions are very strong. Their feelings are very strong towards one another. Should they act on that? We'll see that in a moment. But we rob ourselves of the true intimacy of the relationship if we just jump right to the physical, if we don't keep it in its proper context. We also see that the way a man treats a woman indicates the way he sees her. We pick up in verse 2 of chapter 2. He says this, as a lily among brambles, so is my love among the young women. Ever heard someone called a rose between two thorns? This is where it comes from. And he points out, again, her unique beauty. I mean, can you imagine being the girls on the side being described as brambles? Whew. He's being pretty exclusive here. In all the harshness of the world, he is saying that she brings pleasure and delight into his life. She is something sweet and beautiful to him. Husbands, do you still talk about your wife this way? Do you still talk about the comfort that she brings, the joy and delight that she cultivates in your heart? Or do you just say, I told you on our wedding day I love you, I'll let you know if that ever changes? If you see this about her, treat her that way. Talk to her that way. God's pleased when you do. She is something sweet and beautiful to him. And there's this reciprocity going on. Now she's going to tell him about what she thinks of him. She says, as an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. With great delight I sat in his shadow, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. She's talking about how he has treated her. He's given her provision and protection. Trees in the desert of that region provided shade and refreshing food, but it was protection from the harshness of the environment. Do you see the intimacy developing and blooming between the two of these? Because of how he sees her. And then she says, he brought me into his banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. This is where that children's song about Jesus says, his banner over me was love. Well, yes, his banner over us is love, and we are his bride. That's not the original context. A banner was carried into battle. and it would have some symbol on it that identified your unit or you as a particular person. And it was a rallying point. In the midst of the battle, this is what you come back to. What is the rallying point in this relationship? Love. That means no matter what is going on out there, honey, here you are loved. Husbands, does your wife feel that? Does she feel safe around you? Are you a source of provision and protection for her? I'm not saying you've got to make more money than she does. I'd be a hypocrite. It doesn't work that way in this world all the time. But if she does not feel that you are a provider and a protector, we are missing our banner. His banner over me is love. Now, last time I checked, I don't remember seeing in any fashion, in any culture, women actually wearing a banner. Like there's a big old pole sticking up out of their back with a flag on it going, love, he loves me, he loves me. But I will tell you this. Whenever you meet a couple, or even just the girl, you can tell how her man treats her by her countenance. You can tell a whole lot about a relationship by her countenance. Have you ever seen the young lady, she walks in and she is confident, she is comfortable, she is smiling. And I can go, her man's treating her right some way. What about this? Girl walks in and she's reluctant. She's quiet. Keeps to herself. You know, I'm all right. She needs her man to encourage her a little more. I'm not saying that's always the case. But quite often, the banner of one's countenance gives an indication of how the relationship is going. Because how he treats her reflects how he sees her. Finally, the way a man treats a woman enhances the way she sees him. She responds after saying, his banner over me is love. She says this, sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. His left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. In some translation, it says, may or his right hand and left hand. This seems so out of context. What do the raisins and apples even mean? That doesn't make any sense. She's just talking about some really nice fruit? Well, they're both fruit that are associated with the concept of fertility. Let's just say she's making a move. That's rather forward. She's making the first move, and she's responding with expressions that she wants him physically. And then she goes on to describe, may it be in a very intimate position. Is God okay with that? They're not doing anything. They're just expressing, is God okay? Is the Bible going to call out her lust? Is it going to reprimand her for this desire? Is the groom going to say, be away from me, you vile woman, you daughter of Jezebel? Is that what's going to happen here? Is the man going to give her what she wants? Okay, honey, you're making the move. I'm in. What I want you to understand, and we're not going to make a judgment call on this yet, but I want you to understand something, that the feelings are okay, but it's in the wrong context. The feelings are good things, but not yet to be fulfilled. The desire and even voicing it, the action, is the issue. We need to exercise caution here, stirring up things. But there is a health to expressing this. Look, I am wildly attracted to you. I like the way you look. You're pretty, all these things. I just wish I could, you know. There's something healthy. Barbara Rainey puts it this way. Like a soft, deep layer of mulch, transparency in your marriage will keep most weed seeds dormant and unable to sprout. If you are transparent with what's going on inside and committing yourself to not letting that become an action on the outside, it does two things. It enhances respect for one another. I love you too much to jump ahead, to jump the shark, to jump the gun. And secondly, it enhances the relationship because you go, oh, okay, good. I'm not the only one that's feeling that in the relationship. But look at how he responds to her. I mean, he's been treating her very nice, and she is very attracted to him. Look how he responds to her. If you are going to underline one verse in this book, this is it. Underline it, because this is the man speaking. And he says this, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases." She just came on to him, and he goes, whoa, pump the brakes, not the right time. Men, would you have the strength to do that with someone who's dating you? I would struggle in a dating situation. He's telling her, this is a good feeling, not the good time that God has designed it for. Do not awaken love before its time. Now, this is before they're married. Husbands, wives, let me ask you, are you awakening love now that it is love's time? Are you stirring it up in one another? Are you provoking that romantic intimacy? And by the way, this is sheerly by the power of God, because when it comes to this sort of thing, women are often like crockpots. Not crackpots, crockpots. Hear me clearly. One of the worst tortures in my life is when my wife is making a meal in the crockpot and I happen to be home that day. And you can smell it going all day long. And it smells so good. Your appetite is just going. And by the time you are ready to eat, you are ready to eat. Guys, that's the way it works for most women. It takes a long time. While we men are like microwaves. Beep, beep, boop. Heat it up for 30 seconds, ready to go. He clearly is a man of good character. Because this has been going on, this entire conversation has been cooking up, and he says, hold on, pump the brakes. He is still being selfless. Clearly, he desires her. Selfishly, he could want her. But he says, no, I love you too much to let physical intimacy become our go-to right now. Women, I repeat to you, find a man who submits to God more than his passions. Find a man who is willing to say, no, 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 no. We are not going there. Not yet. Find a man that runs and flees from youthful lusts. All the other sins in Scripture, we are told to stand against. But when it comes to lust, we are told to run away. Why? Because it's a losing battle if you hang around. It defeated Solomon. It defeated David. It defeated so many men in Scripture. It defeated some of the greatest men in history. You think you're strong enough to resist it? Good luck. You're going to need it. But he does say, he doesn't judge her. He doesn't say, whoa, 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 lady, what are you talking about? No. This is a good feeling, but it's not yet time. Remember, sex is a gift from God. He gave it to us. As a wedding gift, don't spoil it by unwrapping it early. He recognizes that a good man is going to take responsibility here. In his book, Raising a Modern Day Knight, Robert Lewis gives a definition of manhood as one who rejects passivity, accepts responsibility, leads courageously, and expects God's greatest reward. Notice the groom in this scenario. He doesn't say, well, she's coming on to me. Might as well. He rejects passivity. He says, this is not just going to happen to me. I'm going to happen to it. This is not going to happen. And he accepts responsibility. He says, I am adjuring you. I am telling you, don't do this before it's time. He leads courageously. He says, whoa, whoa, I'm in this for the long haul. You don't have to rush into this. That takes courage. And then he expects God's greater reward. God has a set time and place for this within a proper context. He recognizes that as a man, he needs to be able to say no to his body. Look, any nudnik can be a biological father. Doesn't take much. Just saying yes to your impulses and no to every ounce of common sense. It takes a real man to say no to my body, to say yes to God. That takes guts. That takes courage. That takes strength. Because it always feels right in that moment. Always. Everything in you is geared to say, this is right. And in a way it is, but not right now. That's the problem. A good thing at the wrong time. So what is the magic of marriage that changes it all? Why all of a sudden you exchange vows and now it's okay? We'll get into that a little bit more in chapter 4 in a couple weeks. But for now, I just want to talk about three things that happen. Tom Nelson, in his book, The Book of Romance, he puts it this way. Imagine I come into your house and I've got a bundle of sticks and we're in your living room and I've got some marshmallows and some chocolate and some graham crackers and I decide we're going to start a fire in your living room. We're going to have some s'mores. And at first, it's a little exciting. It's like, oh, we're doing something sneaky. And we're going to have s'mores. It's going to be so great. And then all of a sudden, the carpet catches fire. Oh, no. It's not exciting anymore. It's exciting in a completely different way. And now the walls are on fire. Now the living room's on fire. Now the whole house is on fire. Because why? It wasn't contained. Now imagine a very different scenario. I come to your house. I have a bundle of sticks. All the fixings for s'mores, and you have a fireplace. And I build a fire in there. And we can make our s'mores. There's no risk, no danger. Not as exciting, perhaps, but it's definitely more enjoyable, more comfortable. Why? Because it's contained. It is in its proper place. It's safe. I can remember when I was a child, my grandfather, I can't say child, I was just beginning to go through the change, and my grandfather had a talk with me. He said, Aaron, in your day and age, you're going to hear a lot about safe sex. I want you to understand that this thing right here is the only thing you need to have safe sex. I didn't understand it as a child, didn't make sense to me physiologically, but then I realized what he was talking about. That sex has this way of connecting souls, of causing tethers between two hearts. And it's only within the context of marriage that determines whether it will destroy you or build you. It is a fire. Secondly, it'll hinder communication skills. A good marriage is built on communication. But if you can just jump to the intimate without having a conversation, why talk? It feels good while we're doing that, so why not just do that? And thirdly, it gives an unhealthy illusion of health that, okay, as long as this one area is going on and good, we're healthy, we're set. Granted, if it's not going well, that does indicate there's something not healthy. But that's like saying, just because my car has good tires, it drives fine. You're going to need a whole lot more than that for a healthy marriage. It gives you a false sense, and it has the law of diminishing returns because, okay, once this has been going on for a while, once there's intimacy for a while, all of a sudden it's no longer appealing. It's no longer as exciting. So you got to try something else. You got to step into new territory. You got to push the boundaries. So I just want to, in a moment, while we close the dating phase here, I want to touch on four hot button issues. Extended guy-girl relationships, just really quickly. And I'm talking about friendships. Is it possible to have a platonic friendship for a long period of time? Possible, yes. Probable, no. More than likely, statistically speaking, one of you is going to catch feelings for the other. So look out. Secondly, long-term dating relationships. Time plus communication equals intimacy. And it's harder to not awaken love before it pleases. As I said earlier, when you bring in the emotion and you dive deep emotionally, and when you bring in the spiritual, you start praying together, having devotions together and all of that. And that's good things, wonderful things. And within their proper boundaries, all of a sudden we get shocked because the physical wants to catch up with the emotional and spiritual. It's because we are a whole being. You cannot simply compartmentalize the physical. It will catch up. I also want to talk to those who struggle as a single and think that a relationship is the solution. We become relational addicts. If you're not content outside of a dating relationship, hear me clearly, you have nothing to offer inside a dating relationship. Because Christ is the only one who is sufficient in our life. A relationship is a great addition to what Jesus is already doing, but it is not a replacement for it. And finally, make it less about what is out there and more about what is in here. Stop seeking the right one or even the right type of one. Be the right type of one. Singles that, I've seen it time and again, a single person that their heart is on fire for God, they are fully devoted to Him, they are spending time in His Word, they're active in His church, they're serving in their community, and then they get into a dating relationship, and now I don't have enough time to serve, and now I'm not going to be involved in church, and so on and so forth, and it changes them. Because they get caught up in that dating relationship rather than the foundational relationship they have with God. That closes the dating segment. Now, quickly, we're going to work through the courting as we do. I want to caution you in this with the words of John MacArthur. He says, the first characteristic of sexual sin is deceit. It never delivers what it promises. It offers great satisfaction, but it gives great disappointment. It claims to be real living, but it's really the way to death. By the way, he's coming off of the passage in Proverbs that we looked at when he says that. Don't make it about the physical enjoyment of each other yet. Good feelings, wrong time. So, now we need to look at the courtship phase when, okay, we are heading towards marriage. In verse 8, there's an increased commitment that brings increased fear. There's now a heightened sense of risk. There's something to lose. There's something that they might possibly have the pain of its absence. The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, looking through the lattice. Guys, don't try this in the dating relationship. You get in trouble. Can't look through the windows and lattice. No, what is she saying here? She's anticipating him coming for her. Oh, there he is. He's here. They're going to go on some sort of exciting adventure together. And then she says this, my beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away, for behold, the winter is past, the rain is over, and gone. The flowers appear on the earth. The time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree ripens its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come away. What's this describing? It's springtime. The relationship is now budding. It is blooming. They're not fighting all the time. There is wholeness and health in the relationship. Because is that really God's provision for you if you're in a relationship with somebody that fights with you all the time? That drains the life out of you? Robs you of spiritual life? Or what if it would be someone that instead of fighting with you all the time, fought for you? That brought life to you? That enriched your walk with God? And she is feeling vulnerable, let me tell you guys. She's scared. She's searching for him, and she is falling for him. Because she goes on to say, oh, my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the crannies of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet, and your face is lovely. He's saying, where'd you go? Why is she hiding? Is she frightened? Is she concerned? Well, more than likely, she's concerned that he's too good to be true, that the guy that she has been dating this whole process is not the real guy. He's just been putting on a good front, that when they get married, he's going to become somebody else. There's increased fear. Be prepared for that as you increase the commitment. I can remember as soon as I asked Adri to marry me, how scared I was that she would come to her senses. That one day she would wake up and go, "Who is this bozo?" There was fear because she held my heart. Still does. That increased commitment brought increased fear, but also increased effort. Dating is a little easier than this phase. In verse 15, we pick up, it says, "Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that spoil the vineyards, for our vineyards are in blossom. My beloved is mine, and I am his. He grazes among the lilies." She's calling him to protect the vineyard in early phases. That's a metaphor for their relationship. It's a picture of them together. And she's asking him, are you willing to work on the relationship in the early phases as well as later on? Now that it is in blossom, now, right now, when it is early, got to put the work in to avoid those problem causers. That's the way to enjoy the most fruits in a healthy marriage. Put the work in. Put the effort in. It's worth it. There's a proverb that says, where there is no ox, the stall is empty. Stall is clean. Hey, Brian, cows, nice clean critters, aren't they? No, not by a long shot. But in order to have them around, you got to keep shoveling, don't you? See, the ox would save a lot of work. Taking care of it might be a lot of work, but it's a whole lot less work than living without it. Keep shoveling. Keep that work. As Paul put it in 1 Corinthians 7, he says, "I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife." By the way, that's also in addition to pleasing God. "And his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and in spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband too." It takes work to be married. It's not like you put the ring on and boom, I'm done. We don't have to date anymore. We don't have to invest in each other anymore. No. In fact, now the real work begins. We'll dive into that next week. She says this, "My beloved is mine, and I am his. He grazes among the lilies. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag on cleft mountains." Or, as some translations have it, the mountains of Bethar. I really struggled with this section. What is she saying? That makes no sense. There's a hint here, two things. First of all, she talks about him as a gazelle or a young stag. These were symbols in the ancient Eastern fertility religions for stamina, physically. And the word bethar means to separate or to cut. I want you to be a stud on the split mountains. Draw your own picture here, mentally. She is drawing him in, and she's saying, I want your focus here, buddy. All night. Till morning breathes. And we open the cover again and go, really, that's in here? Yes. The problem is not the sexuality. The problem is our view of it. We don't understand the beauty that comes from being that intimate in marriage as God designed. That's why I'm really encouraged by musician Adam Kappa. He says this, "Men, women don't need a knight in shining armor. They need a man covered in the armor of God." She's coming on strong. If he didn't have the armor of God on, metaphorically speaking, he would be in trouble. But with this increased commitment, there is now increased effort. They're heading towards the wedding. He's aware of this. Increased commitment brings increased danger. And we close out with the first five verses of chapter 3. On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. The watchmen found me, and as they went about this in the city, have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go, till I had taken home to meet Mama. She's bringing him home to meet the family. By the way, this would be the first step in the courtship process of introduction to Mom and Dad to get the blessing. By the way, not likely it would be the first meeting. They had arranged marriages. But then she makes a very, very bold move into the chamber of she who conceived me. They're in a bedroom, and she is focusing on one significant concept, conception. She wants to move this process along. She wants to rush it. We are heading towards the wedding. Does that sound like our culture today? No. It's always the guy pressuring, the guy rushing it. Guys, she is pushing towards this. How does he respond? Remember, that attraction is not deserved or demanded. It's earned. The way he has treated her so far has earned this sort of response from her. How does he respond? Well, we're heading there anyway. Might as well dive in. He repeats again, underline this again, just as he did in chapter 2, verse 7. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, symbols of fertility, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. He says again, good feelings, but not yet. Yep, I'm with you there, honey. I feel the same thing. We need to wait, that's all. Because the fireplace hasn't been built yet. He is still aware of the dangers. By celebrating purity and refusing to pursue sexuality, guys, listen to what you're telling her. You're demonstrating that you can be trusted, that sexuality outside of marriage will never be an option for you in the future. She's never going to have to wonder what you do against her because of what you have already refused to do with her. You've proven it, that you can be trusted. Now, she's come on to him pretty strongly, which runs against the grain of our culture. But this sort of attraction, he's earned it. It's a privilege. It is not a right. We'll deal with the intimacy issues later. But understand now, he has put in a lot of work. And the fruit is there for all his work. He could just indulge. But he knows the timing is not right. I love the way Marshall Segal puts this. When we choose to pursue purity and postpone intimacy, Jesus' sacrifice looks costly, like our most expensive and prized possession. Look, if you're struggling with this, let me encourage you to keep your focus on Christ. Well, I said this book is not about Jesus and the church yet. If what we just talked about doesn't evidence that to you, I also want to encourage you to keep your eyes on Christ. Because when you recognize what he has done to preserve us from the dangers that this is talking about, good feelings, wrong time, we begin to understand that he is our most expensive and prized possession. When we do not push boundaries, we announce the priceless weight of every one of his wounds. When we keep our clothes on and our hands from wandering, we celebrate the immeasurable mercy he carried on a back destroyed with lashes. When we wait in dating, we declare again that he really is risen from the dead and reigning in heaven. Our sexual purity will either make the cross look real and valuable, or it won't. with our eyes happily fixed on Jesus, the once for all sacrifice for our sins, he will increasingly be honored in our bodies, whether in singleness or marriage. That's why this is for all of us. Protect it. It is a precious gift. So I just want to give a couple questions if you are in the courtship phase and some suggestions overall for today. If you're in the courtship phase, let me ask you, are you ready? Guys, can you say, good feeling, not yet, like this guy does in 2:7 and 3:5? If not, you're not ready. You have not yet earned that level of commitment. You are not yet safe in that level. You cannot protect her. Keep growing. Take some time to get there, to develop that character. I don't say that judgmentally because I've been there. I'm a guy. I was not born with a Bible in my hand. I was born with the same urges in my heart as are in yours. So take time, develop that character, and make yourself ready. Have you watched this person over time? Guys and girls, both. Guys and ladies. I mean, Abraham sends out his servant Eliezer to find his son a wife, and he has to watch Rebecca for a while before he goes, okay, yeah, she's the right one. Take some time. You've got it. I mean, if you're planning to spend your whole life together, might as well take a little bit of your life now to determine what that person's like. And is this relationship life-giving? Can you say, oh, this feels like springtime? Or is it a drudgery like the middle of winter or right now the first week of summer? Oh, it's killing me. It's a drudgery. So here are some suggestions. The key to courtship is intentionality, a declaration of stepping up. Courtship doesn't stop just because you get married. Keep dating. It begins with cultivating a friendship. Are you still friends with the person you're married to? I'd hope so. One of the saddest fates I've ever seen in a marriage is when they can't stand to be around each other, but they stay, either for the kids or because they're afraid of breaking the covenant. I'm not saying that they should get a divorce. I'm saying they should rekindle the friendship. This is an opportunity where he gets to practice leading and she gets to guard her heart and learn to follow. Guys, tell her who you desire exclusive time to get to know each other better. You take the lead on this one. Speak to a spiritual authority in her life. Is this the right time? Whether that's her father, grandfather, pastor, someone who knows her well and has spiritual insight, ask, look, I'm interested in taking this relationship to the next step, but I don't know, is she ready for that? Then have a boundaries conversation. Stay committed to your boundaries. And don't ask this question. So many times we ask, how far is too far? How far can we take this? Instead, the question should be, how godly can we be in this relationship? Talk about your baggage in your relationship. Every single one of us comes into a relationship with some sort of baggage, emotionally and physically. Don't give all the gory details. Have this rule about it. Will this be beneficial to the relationship to share? And then finally, this one seems rather simple, but discuss marriage. Talk about it. What does it mean to you? What do the roles look like? What would that look like for both of you? Man, you might be listening going, Pastor, you have gone really long. You have talked about a lot of things we got to do. This is a lot of work. You're setting a really high bar. You might be wondering, is this all worth it? Let me tell you this. The only thing worse than being single and wishing you were married is being married and wishing you were single. It's worth the effort to search it out. Now, maybe some of you are sitting here and you're thinking, man, I've blown it. Maybe you've crossed lines you wish that you hadn't. I've been there too. And when Adrian and I first started dating and then got into very, very, the engagement phase, the courtship phase, I remember thinking to myself, man, I don't deserve this, God. Are you sure you got the right guy? Because I don't deserve her. I still don't. And he goes, whoa, whoa, pause. When have I ever given you something you deserved? I'm the God of grace. Friend, the gospel applies to you too. Let me encourage you to take it back. There is a time for the gospel to come into those relationships, to restore what the locusts have eaten, to have a fresh start, a new beginning, for God to bring beauty out of the ashes, to let dry bones live again, to bring back that beauty. It's never too late for the gospel, because it's not how you start, it's how you finish. For this, today we are going to finish talking about the love of God. It's the love of God that will help you protect this in your relationships. It's the love of God that we point to in our relationships. Now, I know in our day and age, the message I just preached is very taboo, countercultural. And some of you would say, look, that's not the way marriage works anymore. That's not the way sex works anymore. In fact, this is my body. I can do with it what I see fit. Let me encourage you. Number one, God created marriage when he put the first man with the first woman. Secondly, he invented sex when he created the male and female. And third, your body, not your choice. That's why in 1 Corinthians 6, Paul says this, flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit in you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. You're not your own. God knows how it works best. It's his property. Listen to him. Let's pray. God, our Father, thank you for the beautiful warning. The beauty of intimacy without the physicality. Lord, I pray that we would constantly pursue purity, that we would trust you that this is better, that there is more joy to be derived from this than the quick, easy, cheap version the world sells us, that our own mind and heart try to convince us of. Father, would you bless the relationships? Would you give us the courage to stand up and say no to our impulses, to say yes to something that is far better? I pray this in Jesus' name and for your glory. Amen.